Welcome everyone for our fourth week of this really important and deep study as the wisdom Jesus looking at our disordered world. And as is our tradition, I'd like to offer a prayerful invitation to bring us into presence again, to listen to our heartfelt attention to this new and profound teaching on the evolution of consciousness by our new friend and seasoned wisdom teacher, Rebecca Parker. So I'd like you to listen to the words of our dear friend, Mirabai Starr, who has been with us here at Word and Life. And just listen to these words carefully with your heart. It's that keeping the heart open, even in hell, that makes space for the beloved. It is in the darkest nights of our soul, when all we know is that we know nothing, that the presence of the sacred may quietly well up, mingling with our pain and connecting us to a love that will never die. So it's my great pleasure to introduce this fourth week offering. Today's teaching is a foundational piece of understanding that provides us with a radically different perspective to view the evolution of human consciousness toward that place of divine union, the omega point, the perspective of unified consciousness. Our dear new friend and speaker today will take us on a journey into the beginnings of our human consciousness and explore how we have entered into an inflection point in this process of becoming human, of being human. This will be a new teaching for most of you, and I encourage you to open your heart and mind as to the enormous implications it has for our foray into the encounter with dysfunction and evil that is sort of the focus of our study these 10 weeks. Rebecca has become a new friend to me in the past couple of years, and I'm impressed with the alignment of her work with that of Word and Life. She's the executive director of the Mary and Martha's Place in Atlanta, which is a center for spiritual formation and transformation within the Christian tradition. She's an ordained Presbyterian minister and has been a dedicated wisdom student of Cynthia since 2011. It was her initial inquiry that led us into this current focus of Cynthia's on encountering evil through wisdom teachings. And I believe her quote may resonate with many of us in this community. Wisdom is a love affair, and the work is to clear my heart enough to hear the beloved calling and to live from this experience in the world. And now I'm pleased to continue our tradition of welcoming and blessing our speakers with the late Tom Heck's beautiful blessing song. Please raise your hands in blessings as we sing these words.
We bless you as you share your gifts of spirit, light, and insight. We welcome you with joy.
And I give you Rebecca Parker and her offering on the teachings of John Gebser. Here's Rebecca.
Good morning. Thank you. What a lovely blessing. I'd heard you do it before, but it's really different when it comes from you and it lands in your heart. Thank you. I just wanted you to know that I know of Casa de Maria. I first met Mary Ann a long time ago at the Teilhard Wisdom School that Cynthia was teaching. So I have some sense of your place and where you are and the work that you do. And I'm grateful for all the circles that hold this space, and you're one of them. So thank you for having me today. I first came into the work with, or came to know about the work with John Gebser through Cynthia. And I want to give you some background so you know how it's connected. I think just to hear the words, it can seem like, why this piece? Where is it coming from? And it's all part of the building block of helping us understand and give context to the times in which we're living. We don't have to be told that it's a dysfunctioning time. It's a divisive time. It's an unstable time. And when we see this, I think one of the questions that can arise is, what is the cause? And is there such thing as evil? there was a woman in our study circle that really wanted to explore that. And in conversation with Cynthia, the conversation about evil grows out of a much larger conversation, which is to examine, it's really, what does it mean to be human? Who is God and what is our place? And those are the questions that frame the conversation for us. And I think it's also what connects us with Wisdom Jesus. What I want to do here today is keep the context large. So we are looking at difficult times. How do we begin to name this as evil? What are our tools? And one of the tools is understanding the consciousness that we are living in, that we take so for granted, we can't begin to see it. And what Gebser is going to point out for us is that we are in a deficit decline of a particular structure of consciousness. And there are repercussions and we're living in it. And when we can't see it, it feels like destruction rather than being able to see that there's something much larger. This, I think Gebser's work gives us perspective. So that's how I came into it. Cynthia ran across a small book by a man named Jeremy Johnson. Jeremy Johnson is a person who is, he wrote the book Seeing Through the World. That's the book that she saw. P.S. I'm going to say a lot of resources today, and I suspect that you all are readers just like I am, and you're going to want to know, well, what book was that? Well, where is that? I have a resource sheet, but I purposely did not send it to you ahead of time, because if you're like me and you're a reader, you want to start reading, but these resources are so many and they run deep. So you will have something afterwards, I promise. So Jeremy Johnson, Cynthia finds the book on Jean Gebser, and it's opening up a whole new body of work for us. I'm going to say more about Jeremy and the connection with Cynthia in just a moment. The frame, if I were standing in front of you and I had a whiteboard, I'd be drawing an arc as an umbrella of all these different parts that are in conversation with what we're doing today, because I really want Gebser to be talking to Jesus. Chapter 8 in Wisdom Jesus is one of my go-to chapters. I spent almost 2 years teaching this book, and it is rich. And this chapter 8 is the one that I read at the beginning of Advent every single year. So there's so much for us to look at. And Gebser is information in the much larger context of looking at who is Jesus and what is ours to do. So I've got my big umbrella right on the board. And the first thing that I'm putting up is where Cynthia begins to answer this question that we have in front of us. In January the 1st, 2017, in Aspen Chapel, Cynthia preached. So that would tell you that Trump had just been elected and we were right before the inauguration. Cynthia was a guest there, had been teaching, and she preached the sermon that morning. And I feel like it was the introduction. It brings us into a conversation Cynthia's been a part of and has initiated for some time now. And what she did is acknowledge that we are headed into, at that time we thought headed into, we didn't realize how long we'd been in it, deconstruction and disorientation and disagreement. All the things that might have been under the surface were going to come to the fore. So with prescient, I think, she pointed us to three places where she would turn, where she was turning to begin to answer, to respond to what she saw on the horizon. And they were three. It was the work of Teilhard. It was the work is the work of G.I. Gurdjieff. And the third person that she pointed us to at the time was an essay by Ken Wilber. What she ended up saying, and and suggesting that these three people were pointing us to is the way that we respond in these times is transformation of consciousness. There's not a thing to do particularly or a thing to understand, but that we as humans must wake up to the capacity that we have and to what our work is and what our job is here on the planet. And it requires a root system. It requires a deep knowing of who and whose we are and waking up to what our capacities are. With that, Cynthia went on to look at, there was, well, you know, then we come into COVID, then we start into some serious study. And where she went was she found this book, as I just mentioned, by Jeremy Johnson. Jeremy had discovered John Gebser's work. He, at the time, was a young man, probably 32, 34. Now he's still in his 30s. Picked up Gebser's, you know, 3-inch book, The Ever-Present Origin, and was, having been very familiar with Wilbur's work, began to see that Gebser was offering us something much larger and different than what Ken Wilbur had offered. And I'm saying this because I think maybe a number of you might be familiar with Ken Wilbur, and it's important to understand the difference, because if you take this, what I'm getting ready to talk about, the transformation of consciousness, if you take your cue from Ken Wilbur, it will take you it'll take you down the path that's not where Gebser's going. What Gebser was suggesting, now, Gebser was born in 1905. He dies in 1973. So he is Albert Einstein, contemporary of Jung. Freud's material is out. So he's lived through, he'll have World War I and World War II. He is a what they call a cultural philosopher. He grew up in a region that was on the borders of, it's Poland, German, Swiss. It's a combination of different cultural influences. He does not go, he's trained, but he goes on a personal journey. And I'm going to say a little bit more about that. So his path is not typical. Jeremy discovers Gebser's work, and Gebser's talking about structures of consciousness, which is not the same as stages of consciousness. Ken Wilbur took Gebser's material and in his own thought process, saw it as a process where we go from one to the next, and one stage builds on the next stage and builds on the next stage. Gebser was not saying that. He's saying that we have structures of consciousness that are whole and unto themselves, and they look differently, and they have different perspectives, and they teach different, they're a worldview. And all of those structures dwell within each of us, but they are latent. The early ones are latent, but that's different than an earlier body of people not being whole. So we're talking about structures, and we'll continue to use the word structures and not stages of consciousness. Well, this really excited Cynthia, and she wanted to put Gebser in conversation with other writers that she knew. And hence she went off on a journey. You will have in your resources a 12-part blog series that outlines who Gebser is and why for her Gebser is important. And that's in effect the arc we're covering today, because where this material is going to take us is to Wisdom Jesus, chapter 8. Wisdom way of knowing that you've been in. So let's see. The other thing I want to say, again, we'll pick it up, is this word origin. Gebser is going to say, and I think that you would find it in the mystics and you would find it in Cynthia's writings, that origin is the word that Gebser gives it. Cynthia often talks about the initiating force that creates the entire cosmos as the desire of formlessness that moves into form. And there are the different worlds that are created. And the one that we live in on this earth plane is the one that we're talking about with Gebser. There are other planes. We're not going into those today. But what does it mean to be human here on this earth plane? And the word, this formlessness come into form, this creating energy, this we sometimes what we call it is love, that brings all things into being. That origin runs through every single structure that we're going to talk about. There's not one that contains less. We're going to discover with the mind we have, we want to compare and contrast. That's how we figure things out. Well, comparing and contrasting is not how all these structures of consciousness work. So with that said, I want to take us into these very simply. There's not enough time to be able to go into great depth. The point is to give you an idea about the structures so that we can get to the structure we're living in. Where I'm headed is to be able to talk about the mental rational structure that we live in. And I think when we get a perspective there, we don't feel so stuck about the times we're living in. It gives us more breathing room and space to make other decisions. And then this arising structure that is so well informed by Jesus begins to have a space for us. So let me say just a little bit more about these structures. The work that I am using is particularly well summed up by a man named Ed Mahood Jr., Mahood. And the title of his article is The Primordial Leap and the Present. It's a beautiful piece of work. And again, you'll have access to this. It can be accessed off the internet for free and downloaded. So we've said something about Gebser's background, born in 1905, dies in 1973. He finds himself in his early 20s, very interested in, of all things, poetry, and a deep interest in what is happening with the cultural mind. Mahood says this, Gebser's writings, throughout all of Gebser's writings, we find him wrestling with this subject, trying to find real answers to the important questions in life. Who am I? Where do I come from? And where am I going? This work is an answer to all these questions on behalf of all of us. So for the remainder of his life, the bulk of his life, and his fundamental theme was the evolution of consciousness as he explored those questions. I'm going to go on here. He says that the fundamental premise of Gebser's work is that we are on the threshold of a new structure of consciousness. That's critical. That's what our work here is today with Jean before we move to Jesus. The fundamental premise of Gebser's work is that we are on the threshold of a new structure of consciousness that he will call integral. Now, as you know, Wilbur used the phrase integral, but when Gebser uses it, it has a different nuance. There's similarities, but we will do some, we'll do some look at what Gebser is alluding to. So we are on the threshold of the deconstruction and a coming to an end of a particular structure of consciousness that we call the mental rational. And the arising of the integral. Think of what it's like at any time in your own life when something is coming apart, a divorce, before you have found your new normal, having a child, getting a new grocery store, for heaven's sakes. You know, the traffic patterns change. It's something has to happen. There's a deconstruction before the new thing arises. And we are living in the midst of one of giant proportions. I'm going to give you some, I'll give you dates and some ways to help frame this. But I want us to see that that's the reason for these words. And I'm going to briefly introduce you to these other structures of consciousness that all dwell within us. They're latent in us. And as Cynthia has cautioned, our job is not to try to get back to previous structures of consciousness. The answer's not there. The answer, if you will, is hearing origin, the holy, that formlessness into form that is woven into all things. Wisdom Jesus book. All right. The fundamental premise of Gebser's work is that we are on the threshold of a new structure of consciousness. Gebser describes four mutations or evolutionary surges of consciousness that have occurred in the history of humans. These four mutations or evolutionary surges of consciousness have occurred in the history of man. They are not just changes of perspective. They are not simple paradigm shifts. Rather, they are fundamentally different ways of experiencing reality. They are fundamental ways of experiencing reality. These four mutations reflect different, separate eras of development that are not distinct and isolated from one another, but instead are interconnected such that all previous stages are found in subsequent ones. Gebser identifies these five phases as the archaic, the magical, the mental, and integral. You would think from listing that we are dealing with a historical description of a linear unfolding, and Mahood cautions us that it would be a grave misinterpretation of Gebser's thesis and would do it an injustice to try to see it as linear progressions. So, the archaic structure. The archaic structure of consciousness is perhaps the most difficult to understand, for it is the most removed from our present day way of thinking. It is, he says, the best way to say it is a world devoid of any perspectivity at all. It is, we have so little, there's not poetry, there's not pictures, there's really not a way for us to be able to know it at any great detail. He says that a consciousness of maximum latency. This is a term that we're going to continue to use, and that's latency and transparency. These earlier structures, origin that we talk about is latent, but it is there. and over these different structures of consciousness, origin becomes more and more transparent. So he names origin is the source from which all things spring. But it is that which springs. It is the source from which all things spring. It is the essence which is behind and underlies consciousness. Consciousness is neither knowledge nor conscience, but must be understood in its broadest sense as wakeful presence. So we're not going to spend a lot more time on the archaic. I did a 3-month course with Jeremy Johnson, where online, virtual, where we went into every one of these, and there's so many points. But as I said, I'm trying to give you an overview so that we can get to the mental rational. The magic structure of consciousness. It's around some unspecified time in our past. So there's not a date that we can put on when it began, but there where it begins to shift, and it's there's a rising phase that's called the efficient phase in each of these structures, and there's a deficit phase. So there's a reason that it's, if you think about it, like when something's going to change, there's more and more and more capacity to observe that there's something else. And then a balance is tipped and it gathers up until the best of what that structure has to offer begins to go into a deficit phase. And that's what we're looking at now in each of these structures of consciousness. So the magic conscience would end around 40,000 BC. It persisted till around 40,000 BC with the advent of the Cro-Magnon. Humans entered into the second phase of development and gained a new structure of consciousness, the magical structure of consciousness. So we're going to look at just a few things about it. It is egoless. That is, it does not really distinguish, the human there does not distinguish oneself apart from nature. One is a part of all that surrounds one. In the earliest stages, it's hard to conceive that the human can even view oneself apart from the environment. So in other words, the plants, the animals, the other elements in the surroundings share the same fate as the human does. They experience things in a similar manner. There's death, there's life. They are engaged in all aspects of existence. There is not an I factor. It is we dominant. You can think of it almost like a dreamlike state, a recognition. And what begins to tip this balance is there is a growing recognition developing in the human that there is something different from that which is around. It's not fully awake to be able to name what it is to be human, or what the role is in the world. But the human is beginning to recognize itself as an entity. So that's where the shift comes. Mahood points out that where we know magic in our own selves, magic is very much alive today. And it comes as no surprise that there is a strong interest in magic today. It is the most of the structures. It is the most vital and emotional of all the structures. He says, we live in very decisive times, potentially catastrophic times. This is a time when emotion rises near the surface of our consciousness, and it is here that magic manifests itself. So what we're trying to do is just get a taste of what this magic structure was like at its time and where we see it in our own time. So now I'm going to shift to the mythic structure of consciousness. The mythic structure of consciousness is 40,000 to 10,000. This is when a human become a tool-making individual, one who begins to form into larger social structures. And what began to evolve was a symbolic universe that was religious and shamanistic, with a complex mythology arising. This structure can be considered two-dimensional since it is characterized by the polarity of being able to see oneself, beginning to see oneself as human, and being able to see oneself not just as a part of nature. Humans are beginning to recognize themselves as opposed to others. The next 30,000 odd years or so are spent developing various mythologies. Language is becoming ever more important. So in the magic, you didn't really have language. Language is developing here. So as the mythologies grow, the magic structure of consciousness, if the magic structure of consciousness is the emotional aspect, then the mythical structure is the imaginative one. It is this fact that makes mythology so difficult for us as moderns to deal with, because it takes us into the imaginative. What began the demise of the mythic stage was the observation that all of the gods and the goddesses, all and the mythic shamanistic figures began to have so much power over the will of the individual, and there were such constraints that there became, when you get those kind of constraints, it begins to stir the pot and something else begins to arise. And that's what we're going to observe happens in the with the mental rational, which is where we are. Mythology, he goes on, Mahood says, mythology is very much alive today. This explains the popularity of Joseph Campbell and of his work on myth. The imagination, intuitiveness, understanding what stories can reveal to us, helping us move out of thinking and knowing to something that is larger. So it's not that we've left myth behind. I know where you live in Santa Barbara, very close to Pacifica. I've visited and done some coursework there, so we know how powerful the mythic is and what it has to teach us in the current day. It's again, you can see that it's not linear. We're not something we're outgrowing. These structures of consciousness have important lessons, and we bring them with us. So now I want to shift into the mental structure of consciousness. This first part is 10,000 BC to 500 BC. And then we're going to watch as it rises. Then we're going to watch what happens as we continue to live into it in the Renaissance and into our current time. This next transition is 10,000 BC to 500 BC, the transition to the mental structure of consciousness. Mythology had become so deficit that humans needed a clean break with the past, the plethora of gods and contradictory stories of creation, formation of institutions, and so on threatened to overwhelm the consciousness of humans. Humans practically stood on the verge of drowning in a deluge of mythological mentation. In reaction to this, Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, and of course Pythagoras stepped forth to counteract this trend. The mental structure was inaugurated, and this coincides with the discovery of causality. Abstraction becomes a key word to describe mental activity, and we find humans using mind to overcome and master the world around us. With abstraction comes philosophizing and a primary form of expression. Monotheism almost universally replaces the plethora of gods from the bygone days. About the time of the Renaissance, humans came into their own really mastered space. It was at this time that perspective was actually introduced into art. Perspective is the lifeblood of reasoning and the rational structure of consciousness. What we have is the full development of the ego and its related centeredness. We conceive things, events, and phenomena in terms of our own perspective, often at the expense of others. Our language, our entire imagery, and dominant metaphor is visual. Space is finally overcome. It is this concretizing of I. We become very aware of our existence, our beingness, our individuality. But in the deficit mode, the outcome is loneliness, isolation, and alienation. Let me say a little more about this mental ordering. Cynthia talked about it in chapter 3 in Jesus, in Wisdom Jesus, that in our binary thinking system, our proclivity and our way of figuring things out is to compare. One thing is not like the other. And the way, that's how we figure things out, is to figure out what it's not. Another characteristic that Cynthia helps us name is this capacity to look, it's the way that we perceive the world. And it's why the word perspective comes in here for Gebser. We look at everything out of our little eyes. Everything is from my ego, my being, and I look out, and our perspective has us at center, and everything else we break down to look at it. And she gives the example of a house. If you are trying to draw a house, you can't draw the backside, but you can draw the front side. And our mind tends to become constricted around what we can see. What Gebser begins to hold up for us is that where we begin to see a shift in this, he always goes to the artist first, and he looks at what the artists were doing. And he looks at Pablo Picasso. And I'm sure you've seen the paintings where what Picasso has done is taken the human face and painted it so that you can see the whole human. We began having abstract art. All these are the beginning signs of a shift in consciousness. We are living, I think, in the death throes of the mental rational, and why understanding the mental rational has become such an important thing for me. It's become such a tool, because it helps me to be able to recognize that the way I want to live my life. So it starts in the personal, and then we can find it in the communal. We can find it in politics. And that is on a linear timeline. How often do we use the words, I just don't have enough time. I can't fit it all in. It is it's a way of holding the world where we make judgments about how we will use our time, how we will be in the world, all by comparing. And so it becomes, it's two-dimensional. The roundedness to be able to take in something larger and to be able, such as Origen, is not often available to us. There, I want to read you a quote from Nora Bateson. She's the granddaughter of Gregory Bateson, when she's describing this mental rational that we're living in. The whole basis of what is desirable and what it is to succeed is propelling our madness. So she's describing the mental rational. The whole basis of what we desire and what it means to succeed is propelling the madness. No logic can stop it. It isn't logical. It is in runaway gear now. In multiple contexts, ecological, financial, cultural, political, technological, and personal. Things are breaking. Love each other, she says. The other night, my daughter was watching the Grammys, so I was in and out. The way that every person that was up for an award, what we heard was all the successes, how many things had been, how many different things that they had won. All of the analysis, all I could hear was mental rational. If you think about it in business, we make our judgments around percentages. How much do we have? How little do we have? It is the way that we go about being in the world. We judge children this way. We judge success this way. We have standards, and it has put us in a place where there is so little heart and so little soul. There is an author that I want to look at just briefly, and then I want to turn us to, I'm going to mention it. I don't want to run out of time because I want to look at chapter 8 in Wisdom Jesus. The person that I'm referencing here is a book by Jim Marion called Putting on the Mind of Christ. And he just has this beautiful description. He says that this is the positive side of mental rational. We now have a global perspective. We're able to no longer define the self in terms only of color, national origin. We see our mission to all people. There's freedom. We have ways that we can, there's global communication, environmental safeguards. But psychologically, we find ourselves an existential crisis. Part of this reason is because of this world of achievement and comparison. We may have achieved great fame, produced art, have buildings in our names. He goes on and on. But we know that nonetheless, we are going to die and that none of these immortality projects can keep us alive. And he goes on to say that as a result, despite all our outside successes and achievements, we may be and often find ourselves in deeper agony. We often struggle in vain to discover meaning in our lives and suffer profoundly when meaning cannot be found. And he goes on to say that there is that what needs to arise for us is this capacity to observe and to be able to drop from the mind into the heart. And I want to say that as this, when we find ourselves in this place of the mental rational deficit and moving toward, hopefully moving into this next place of the integral, what are our tools and what are we being handed? And I think that that's where Cynthia's work is so useful, and the work of Richard Rohr and Jim Finley and other people that you have studied. It's offering us this tool of being able to work out of not one center, the mind, but to be able to work out of the three centers. When Heather spoke to you 2 weeks ago, and she looked at chapter 3 in Wisdom Jesus, she looked at one of the core principles that's there, and that is this drop, the capacity to drop the mind into the heart, that the overworking rational mind can begin to have a way to observe and stand outside oneself, and we watch ourselves and what we are doing. And in the observing, we create the space to be able to make other choices. And what Cynthia is holding up for us in this Wisdom Jesus, and in the book that you studied previously, The Wisdom Way of Knowing, is that there is another path, and that what Jesus came to do was to awaken us, to offer us another vision of what it is to be human. In this, you are in chapter 8, going into a second section of the book. The incarnate, you'll be looking at this chapter 8 is incarnation, but it looks also at the passion and the resurrection and the crucifixion. And what Cynthia is offering and is explaining in this chapter 8 is that Jesus' very life was a sacrament. And by sacrament, we mean, she says, it is a sacrament is an actual spiritual energy empowering us to follow the path that Jesus' teachings have laid out. So we come into the actual power and capacity to be able to live out this this new way of knowing. And it has to be something that we begin to live into. It's very hard to name. But as we are able to strengthen our body sensing knowing center and the heart center and drop out of this ego mind into the heart, the things that you've been studying, then we begin to find our ground in the integral way of living. And it's what Jesus came to teach us. This work is one that poetry helps us into, that our own encounter with the holy and ways of seeing, the way that we can see light on the side of a mountain. There's something deep that begins to arise in us. And that is what has the capacity to give us a doorway out of this mental rational that we are bearing the weight of, that we can barely see our way out of. I want to give you an opportunity. It's time to go into the groups. I want you to be able, you have some questions. I want you to be able to have some time to talk out loud about some of the things that this is bringing up for you. When we come back into the question and answer period, we'll have the ability to hopefully have some more conversation about what origin and this arising consciousness looks like. So I'll leave it with Tim.
Thanks, Rebecca. Would you like to read the questions to send us sure. off to breakout rooms? That'd be great.
Absolutely. Are you going to put them up?
They're in the chat.
Great. So, can you begin to see that our current use of metrics for evaluating everything might be a construct and not a reality? In other words, beginning to look at what we take for granted, perhaps it's not a reality. Perhaps there's another way to be in the world and to share your observations. And where you might see this linear measuring metrics in your own life and in your communities. Then the second question is, what in the teachings, let me see, scroll this up. Hang on. Yes, what in the teachings of the master teacher Jesus come to your mind as direction for the arising consciousness we are calling integral? And then this last question that I was just alluding to, what evidence do you see of the mental rational measuring of time in your own life, business, church, the news, and beyond?
All right, thank you.